Good morning. I'm going to do two things today. Before the break, I'm going to talk about networks, as was just announced, and talk about a network of disco structuring markers and the notion of constructional space. After the break, by way of a wrap up, since this is the last lecture, I'm going to summarize what I think are the main points of each of the lectures. And then leave enough time, I hope, for a considerable amount of discussion of the theoretical issues or any other issues that you would like to address. So networks. You may recall that in the first lecture, second part of the first lecture, I cited a key notion of cognitive linguistics, the idea that constructions are linked in networks. This is something that Langacker said back in 1987 and developed further in 1988. And an important objective that Goldberg articulated in the dimension last time is that construction grammar should be an account of the network constructions that captures our grammatical knowledge in toto. How exactly to conceptualize the network has been a matter of considerable debate. Holger Diesel wrote a book on networks that came out in 2019, mainly asking the question, how do networks get learned by children, not only children, but in acquisition in general, but mainly children. And Zomera and Smirnova in 2020 edited a book that's mainly on networks and diachronic change. Very much work still needs to be done, so I'm going to just scrape the tip of the nice iceberg. It isn't even the tip of the iceberg, it's scraping the tip of the iceberg, because there's a great deal that needs to be done and to be understood about networks. The network is obviously a metaphor borrowed from neurobiology and artificial intelligence, but connectivities and relationships believed to be activatable in the brain. The usual concept of a network is something like this little picture here. It looks like a kind of spider's web of interrelations. But it is very hard to capture such links between constructions, especially abstract ones like schemas, in the two-dimensional space of a desktop. So to date, not very many networks have actually been presented. The type that is normally presented is a taxonomic inheritance network hierarchy, such as this one, which I'm sure you will recognize. It's the kind of hierarchy that Goldberg talks about at length and many other people. The idea is that there are microconstructions, which are abstractions, generalizations over what people say and hear and interpret. These are microconstructions of any size, from word to complex clause. That includes conditional constructions, if-then constructions, for example. These, it is speculated, are generalized over, and people have in their constructicons a subschema, and there may be a higher level schema or other ones, even further higher level schemas. Inheritance networks like this model increasing levels of abstractness as I just described them. So you start at the bottom. We're used to starting at the top with a generative tree, but here you start at the bottom. You start with the microconstructions, these are generalized as subschemas and then schemas. I should say that there is no absolute number of levels. I happen to have three on that particular little hierarchy because that is how I have been discussing the discourse structuring markers in terms of sets within sets. There is no absolute number of levels. I used to talk about micro, meso, and macro levels, three levels that were approximately the ones I just showed. The lowest level, the micro, the level is the most specific and substantive. Meso level is a kind of generalization, and the macro level is a much larger generalization. But I don't use those three levels anymore because I think it depends on the researcher and what is being researched, how many levels you need. There's also the question of the researcher's view of the cognitive commitment, which has been a matter of some debate in the last 2 or 3 years. I mentioned Hilpert's discussion of it in connection with the problem of what we are reconstructing historically. Do we think we are reconstructing what is in the minds of people 200,000-300,000 years ago? Or can we only really provide frames for proposing how to interpret the kinds of changes that occur? So the question raised by the cognitive commitment is, if you're positing 3 or 4 or 5 different levels, are those levels abstractions that the linguist likes to make, very easy to make? Or do you think that those particular abstract levels are actually levels that operate in minds of individuals? In other words, are you claiming that people store the generalizations in various levels, as well as micro constructions in the constructicon? I don't think that has fully been agreed on yet. I think there needs to be more psycholinguistic work to answer that question. But I just want to point out that these networks could potentially be thought to reflect what speakers have in their minds, but the way I think of them is these are essentially generalizations that linguists can find when looking at the data. With that as background, I want to raise today the question how one might visualize a network of connectors that are discourse structuring markers of the types that we have been discussing. There's a connector construction, I suggested, that generalizes over the four types of discourse structuring marker that Fraser in 1996 and many other places has posited. Ones we discussed, elaborative, contrastive, digressive, and he also talks about inferential ones. I didn't discuss a class of inferentials, but I did illustrate an inferential one with After All. Digressive is actually not one of Fraser's categories. He has topic change as a category and would include digressives in topic changes. So we have a connected construction with at least four types of discourse structuring marker. And each type licenses both monofunctional discourse structuring markers and multifunctional discourse markers. So for example, the elaborative construction licenses also, furthermore, which I have said, or hope I have shown, are at least in still in modern English, monofunctional discourse structuring markers, and the discourse marker end. So figure two, which is just coming up, models what I've just been talking about. It's a connected construction with sub schemas, elaborative, contrastive, inferential, and topic change. And each type has several members. It licenses several members. I've only put a few in there for elaborative, but put an and also in further for contrastive, but and all the same for inferential, so and now, and for topic change, by the way. And incidentally, which I did not discuss, but it is digressive, and it's certainly topic changing discourse mark, discourse structuring mark. Inheritance means that each node that is lower in the taxonomy has the properties of the immediately higher node. So to go back here, and also and further, will inherit, that is, have the properties of the more abstract, elaborative construction, which in turn will have the properties of the more elaborate connected construction, more abstract. And the connected construction itself is part of a larger D1 connective schema, a higher level schema. I rather doubt that people store a higher level schema of that level of abstraction in their brains, but they might be shown to by a psycholinguist, I don't know, which is part of why I didn't show it there. But nevertheless, linguists like me like to categorize things into rather general categories that seem to operate in the language as a whole. So connective construction is part of a connective schema, which connects D1 and D2 and specifies the type of relationship between D2 and D1. Now, an inheritance hierarchy at the level of the connector discourse structuring marker will specify the properties that each member of the category has. So, yes, okay. So when you think about a particular constructional grid of the sort that Croft 2001 proposed, and that I have been suggesting for historical accounts of each or most of the discourse markers that we've looked at and discourse structuring markers. The idea is in an inheritance hierarchy, the most abstract higher level properties will be, the term is inherited, but will filter down in some sense to all the others. So they all are going to syntactically be connectors. They all are pragmatically going to be subjective to some degree, because you can't connect without specifying some kind of relationship between D1 and D2. They're all going to be intersubjective, because the job of a connector is to alert the addressee and the reader to the kind of connection that is upcoming. And discourse functionally, they will all BDSMs. The idea is that since that is specified at a fairly abstract level, the connection level, the information about the pragmatics and the discourse function does not have to be specified again for every microconstruction. That's one of the benefits of the inheritance hierarchy. It's to aim to simplify the specifications for each microconstruction. Now, moving on to a second idea, which is the idea of constructional space. Higher level abstract constructions, such as the elaborative construction, have multiple members, and these multiple members are conceptualized as being related to each other in clustering in the constructicon based on meaning, function, and relevance to each other. I have several times mentioned that in historical work, what are often initially rather marginal members of a schema tend to gradually increase in similarity to core members. I think when I was talking about grammaticalization and constructionalization, I mentioned be going to as auxiliary that started out as a rather marginal auxiliary. It was an auxiliary of the future that only denoted or denotes relative tense. But it came to be a more prototypical future auxiliary 100 years after it was initially used as an auxiliary, because it came to be used as a deictic. And all the other already extant futures were deictic. So we're going to came to be used in a way that was more like the core futures. That's a kind of analogy, of course. The terminology that we often use is that the schema is crystallizing, which it has become clearer and less messy, shall we say. Fewer exceptions in it. Distinctions have been made between highly crystallized schemas where all the members are roughly approximately the same with respect to their distributions. And that is being distinguished from a family. So closely similar groupings, the former abstract schema from the researcher's perspective. And Hilpert in 2013 discusses this distinction between a crystallized schema and a family. I wanted to share some of what he says with you about that. He discusses changes observed in Koha in the degree of similarity between the concessive parentheticals, the contrastives, with although, though, if, and while. These are subordinating contrastives, not like the ones that we've been talking about. We've been talking about coordinating contrastives, but they are concessive. And I thought this would be hope it would be of some interest. He uses multifactorial corpus analysis of syntactic contexts of a particular type, which I'm going to provide now. He looks at although used in a number of syntactic contexts. Power, although important, is not everything. Although earning $90,000 a year, she drove a battered 1980 Datsun. All those practices, although acknowledged, are not always followed. Hilpert's question when he did the multifactorial analysis was, does distribution with adjectives, as in one, although important, or ing, as in although earning, and past participles, although acknowledged, remain similar over the periods covered by Koha? So his database is Koha. And the question is, if you look at the syntactic distribution of although and though and if and while, does the syntactic distribution change over time or does it stay the same? And if it stays the same, and there could be a schema, and if it's, they turn out to be more loosely connected with respect to syntax, it could be a family. That's his suggestion. It's a quite detailed study. It takes up a whole chapter, so I'm grossly simplifying. But basically, in 1860s Koha, although, though, and if clustered together in embedded ing clauses. So you find, although, though, if earning $90,000 a year, she, that kind of sentence. And obviously you're not going to find all those sentences with the particular earning 90,000, but what he finds is although, though, and if, some kind of ing, verb ing, relationship following it. But while hardly ever occurs in embedded ing forms like to. So it's very rare to find while earning $90,000 a year, she did something. Okay. And he draws plots somewhat like this, though I've not been able to mimic them very well on PowerPoint. But this is the constructional space of subordinating concessive markers in Koha in the 1860s, based on what he found. The point here is that although, though, and if all behave very similarly with respect to syntax, whereas while doesn't, it's more distant in a constructional space of subordinating concessive markers. In answer to his question, do they stay the same or do they change syntactically? The answer is that over time, although and though became distributionally more similar. In fact, he says they assimilate. They're so close together, you could say they've almost become the same thing. But while, and especially if, become less similar in the syntactic distribution. So he says they dissimilate. So by the 2000s, we get although and though earning, I'm sorry. We get although and though and if earning 90,000 a year. Oh, that was the old one, right? There we are. By the year 2000, we have, although though, earning something, but very few, if earning 90,000 a year, or while earning 90,000 a year. You may recall that in the earlier period here, in the 1860s, we've got although, though and if all behaving very similarly with while separate. And this is what happens when you get to 2000. Although and though are very, very similar. I couldn't get them on top of each other. So imagine them on top of each other because, according to Hilpert, they assimilated. And while, which earlier was partnering with although and though, doesn't anymore, and if is even less likely to occur in the particular construction he was looking at. Of course, because he's doing multifactorial studies, he was looking at all three of the distributional criteria that he selected. But all three together show the same kind of shifts, that although and though come to be very similar distributionally, and if and while become rather different in the kind of concessive work they do, or are concessive work they are used for. So Hilpert concludes that the markers, although, though, if, and while, are functionally similar because they are concessive and they are subordinating concessive. So they form a family of microconstructions in present-day English and earlier. However, they're not distributionally similar enough to form an abstract higher level schema. This is his criterion for a schema. A crystallized schema needs to have members that are syntactically very similar in their distribution. I think he might have concluded that although and though have come to form a sub-schema of subordinating contrastives. But I think he is tending to move away from the idea that we have abstract categories in our brains, in our construction plans. And so basically he's saying this is a family of concessives that share a function, concessive function, but they do not share syntactic distribution, so they form a family. That's his suggestion. I was thinking, how can we use that idea of constructional space to think about discourse structuring markers? It's difficult because ultimately, all the discourse marking constructions, the micro constructions, are networked with each other. They are, after all connectives. But I thought it might be historically useful to think of the following. Since many of the connectors in English derive from spatial constructions and some from temporal, it might be useful to think of space and time and the discourse structuring markers as somehow belonging to the same kind of constructional space in the constructicon. Now, any DSM can, of course, introduce a ditransitive. You can say, by the way, she gave Sam a copy of her book. Instead, she gave Sam a copy of her book. All the same, she gave Sam a copy of her book. You can put any discourse structuring marker before she gave Sam a book, which is ditransitive. But ditransitives as a class have little that is functionally in common with connectives. So they're presumably somewhat conceptually distant from the connective schema in constructional space. Ditransitives are, however, somewhat similar to transitives. Many ditransitives can be used transitively. So she gave them books, and she gave books. This is fine. So ditransitives and transitives are closer to each other in constructional space, I hypothesize, than to spatial adverbs and connectors. That produces a little model like that, where a spatial schema and connective schema, I'm at a very abstract higher level than Hilbert here. These schemas overlap in some respect, space and connective. And over here you have the transitive and the ditransitive overlapping. And there's quite a bit of conceptual space in between. So to summarize this first part, I've attempted to address the questions, what is a network, and how might one visualize a network of discourse structuring markers? The network representations are meant to capture the hypothesis that specific microconstructions are developed within the context of knowledge of related conceptual categories. They are, after all, signs. And going back to Saussure, who is often mentioned in constructional work, signs are linked to each other. They are contexts for each other. And this is a very important notion in construction grammar, that all microconstructions are networked with each other, and they are clustered and in conceptual categories. But as I said, a lot of work needs to be done on understanding, modeling, and testing ideas about networks. It is basically a multidisciplinary exercise. It should combine linguistics, psycholinguistics, neurobiology, artificial intelligence, and many other fields. So I think that's very likely to be happening in the future as multidisciplinary research has come to be extremely important, at least in the US and the UK. So with that, let's have a quick break, 5-minute break again, and then I will summarize the main points of all the lectures to remind you what we have been discussing. And please think about questions that you might have regarding particularly the theoretical ideas that I have attempted to present. So 5 minutes. So let us reconvene. I hope in these lectures to introduce you to a number of key notions in construction grammar, which is a branch of cognitive linguistics. And my main goals have been to show that pragmatics not only fits well into constructional thinking, but crucially needs to be accounted for because it is part of our knowledge of language. And I've also attempted to show how a diachronic construction grammar analysis of the development of discourse structuring markers contributes positively to the challenge that Finkbeiner and others had made of putting pragmatics into construction grammar. So I'm going to summarize what I think are the main take-home points. In lecture one, I outlined the basic principles of cognitive linguistics that Langacker and Goldberg discuss. And I think the main one is that knowledge is that the subject matter of cognitive linguistics is the knowledge of the full range of linguistic conventions. This knowledge is learned. It is not innate, or most of it is not. It is learned through experience. It is part of general cognition. In construction grammar of the Goldberg variety, the knowledge consists of four meaning pairings or constructions. They are also signs. And although a construction is a unit, it has subparts. If it didn't, one couldn't account for differences in dialects or stages of acquisition or of change. The model that Croft suggested is a model that I have found useful to understand the notion of unit, the construction as a unit and its subparts. And I have shown that each one of these properties can change: syntactic, morphological, phonological, semantic, pragmatic, and discourse function. I've focused on the pragmatics and the discourse function and insisted that pragmatics is understood as conventional pragmatics that has to be learned. Lecture two introduced some basic principles of usage-based historical linguistics, and the model of diachronic construction grammar that I presented is constructionalization as developed in myself and Trousdale's book of 2013. I argued that innovation is not change. It is, however, a necessary prerequisite for change. We'll never have change unless there's innovation. But innovation is not change because everybody innovates all the time, and that's not what we mean when we say something has changed linguistically. Change is the development of shared conventionalized usage. And I emphasize the importance of context, co-text in particular, and analogy in change. I presented updated characterizations of constructionalization and constructional changes. Constructionalization is the establishment of a new symbolic association of form and meaning, which has been replicated across a network of language users. And constructions are the result of shared generalizations over constructs. Constructional changes are modulations of contextual uses prior to and following constructionalization. Pre-constructional changes enable constructionalization. They include assemblies of co-textual shifts. And as always in any kind of historical work, I'd like to remind you that no particular change ever has to happen. A pre-constructional constructional change is simply an enabling factor, and it may or it may not survive, and it may or may not enable a constructionalization. It does not determine change. Post-constructionalization changes actualize or spread a construction. They tend to be expansions of various types, including collocational expansions and schema expansions, but they also include obsolescence. And the other point I made was that development of a new construction always entails variation. So you will always find A, the original form, after a change has occurred. You will find the old form coexisting with the newer form in variation. And sometimes, but only sometimes, the new form takes over, or in a more usage-based way of talking, speakers select only the newer form and no longer use the older form. In lecture three, I outlined some characteristics of grammaticalization. Among them, Lehmann's six parameters of grammaticalization, and spent some time discussing Lehmann's and Haspelmath's strong hypotheses of irreversible irreversibility of unidirectionality. And I pointed out that various people, including Muriel Norde, have shown that although those unidirectionality is relatively well supported, it is not sufficiently supported to justify the statement that unidirectionality is irreversible. Therefore, we can no longer conclude that language is, as Langecker once said, a gigantic expression compacting machine. I pointed out that in grammaticalization work, loss of content meaning or bleaching is balanced by gain in pragmatic meaning. That's a loss and gain model that many people have discussed. The logical outcome of reduction in the process of grammaticalization is expansion of context. I went on to say that grammaticalization work and constructionalization work ask different questions. If you're working on grammaticalization, you could ask, how do grams, markers of case, tense, aspect, and modality come into being, and what mechanisms are involved? But working on constructionalization, one asks, how do constructions, including schemas, come into being, and what mechanisms are involved? There is, of course, an overlap in the morphosyntactic domain. And where there is overlap, the approaches do not compete, but enrich each other. There are, in construction normalization, in construction grammar, many areas that do not overlap with work in grammaticalization. For example, as I mentioned several times, the ditransitives, the development of dative alternation. So the alternation, I gave Sam a bicycle, alternating with, I gave a bicycle to Sam. Likewise, the way construction is not something that one studied in work on grammaticalization. For example, she elbowed her way through the crowd, or she giggled her way through dinner. In lecture 4, I discussed pragmatic markers and characterized them in a number of ways. The most important are that a non-truth conditional contextualizing cues and processing instructions about how to interpret the host clause, they are procedural, typically multifunctional, and not syntactically integrated with the host clause. I apologize about the dog barking. Stop and see what the matter is. This is what happens when you when you live in a COVID world. I'm back. I apologize. Two dogs beating up on a cat needed to be stopped. So I was talking about lecture 4, and there I introduced discourse structuring markers, and I introduced Fraser's four categories: elaborative, contrastive, inferential, and topic change, and pointed out that most of these derive historically from adverbials. I distinguish circumstance adverbials, which are lexical and truth conditional, connectors that are partially lexical and partially procedural, and discourse markers, a subset of connectors, and they are highly procedural. And I proposed a historical trajectory for the development of some discourse structuring markers in English, such as this one, where this is a circumstance adverb that is either spatial or temporal that can be neo-analyzed, constructionalized as a connector, which will be either a monofunctional DSM or later can be a multifunctional DM. The bracketed shift is a constructionalization. So this, the shift here from circumstance adverb that it has the form with spatial or temporal meaning may become or be used as, constructionalized as, inform a connector, in function, a monofunctional DSM or a multifunctional DM. But one of the points I made was that multifunctional DMs derive from monofunctional DSMs, which is why there is this parenthesis here. And that is a post, so I'm going too fast. This first change, circumstance adverb to connector, is a constructionalization. And use of some mono discourse structuring markers as discourse markers is a post-constructionalization, constructional change, and it does not change the syntax. There's no form change. All the closest to a form change that one finds is frequency increase, but that is not always the case. And I propose that the connector is part of an abstract connector construction, which I talked about earlier today, and illustrated with after all, which is, to my knowledge, the richest discourse marker in English with respect to clausal positions and functions in those positions. In lecture five, I emphasize that the account I'm presenting is one among several. And I mentioned three other approaches to the rise of discourse markers. One is grammaticalization, where there's a big problem, which is that the rise of connectors always entails scope increase, whereas in most models of grammaticalization, scope is expected to decrease. Another model I mentioned was pragmaticalization. The problem here is that pragmaticalization seems to be primarily a model that accounts for the rise of discourse markers. So that seems rather unnecessary to have a model that does only one thing. And then I talked about discourse grammar. Pointed out that it is a two-level grammar consisting of sentence grammar and thetical grammar, and that thetical grammar encompasses linguistic units beyond the sentence that are syntactically, semantically, typically also prosodically detached from expressions of sentence grammar, and those include discourse markers. The problem that I see here is that the claim is that theticals are co-opted instantaneously. But I hope to have shown that all but one change, which is all the same, happened over centuries. Nothing instantaneous about them. And they happened in very highly particular co-textual context. For example, for by the way, I illustrated the co-textual context of talk en route and of the non-restrictive relative clauses. So there's plenty of evidence for gradualness in the accumulation of contextual assemblies. So I'm not convinced that there's any evidence whatsoever for discourse markers arising as co-opted theticals. And the one case that happened fairly rapidly has the all the same, has a number of co-textual assemblies that can be pointed to. So that is gradual as well, but over a shorter period of time. Then I turn to three sets of discourse structure marker types. First, elaboratives, which are continuation and expansion of D1. Some of them illustrate argument is a journey, a metaphor identified in Lakoff and Johnson and elaborated on in Kirksgaard. And further is a good example of this. And we find it again in The Digressive, by the way. It's a widely attested metaphor. And I showed how the elaborative construction schema illustrates significant expansion of a schema over the history of English. Lecture 7, I looked at contrastives, but instead all the same anyway. The function of which is to signal that D2 counters D1 in some way. But I used to illustrate the history of changing links among members of a network. I didn't present it as a network, I presented it as a table, but one could attempt to present it as a network on the type I talked about today. But it's frequently used, it has no register restrictions. By contrast, the contrastive all the same is a monofunctional PSM, relatively infrequent, and is used in a restricted set of registers, which is mainly reports and fiction. Those two don't often go together as a set, but in this particular case, they do. And I talked about thank you, all the same, and thanks all the same, which has developed as a politeness formula. And then I went on to discuss digressives, by the way, and the job of digressives is to signal that D2 does not cohere fully with the prior text, and is to be taken as unimportant, a kind of aside. To my knowledge, there are no digressives as such in Old English. By the way, and by the by, both arose in the 17th century. However, if one considers them digressives to be topic changers, then of course there were topic changers from Old English on. Elaboratives and it's a topic changer. The point about digressives is they're really very, very different from other topic changers because they say this is a topic that is not very important. That's not typical of other topic changers. I pointed out that there's an as-if component in many examples, an as-if unimportant, and suggested that this led to use in the 19th century as a hedge attenuating the face threat of an upcoming D2. and in combination with O, by the way, could be used from the 1820s on, in a casual attention-drawing way as a hedge. And this hedge came to be interpreted negatively because it was interpreted as a fake casual remark that is unimportant. And that eventually led to an aggressive use that Marx of this alleged position or inconsistency in position that I called, oh, by the way, too. That was a constructional change. It's not a constructionalization. Yesterday, I talked about discourse markers and discourse structuring markers being combined in a row. And it appears that the combinations are constrained only by more general precedes more specific. And of course, you have to make some kind of coherence. Some combinations with the same function appeared, like, but however, on the other hand, that's one long string. But however, on the other hand, because but however, on the other hand, can occur in a row, no one discourse marker or discourse structuring marker position is meaningful. And I talked about how some combinations have become units, like now then, so that what filled two slots now fills one. Now then, unit status can be identified by increase in frequency of the combination, but most especially by new meaning. I posed two questions with regard to causal position. Is it possible to predict where a particular type of discourse marker may occur relative to the clause, beginning, middle, or end? And I pose the question, is position a construction? I think I may not have been entirely clear what I meant. I meant, is the slot in this D1, D2 configuration, or the slot in the D1, D2 at the end, is it a construction? That's a very abstract idea. Oops, skipping a lot here. Okay. So is it possible to predict where a particular type of DSM may occur relative to the clause? No, because some can occur in all three positions, initial, medial, and final. For example, by the way, and all the same, and after all. And some of them may mean different things in different positions, and after all was my main example of that. And I suggested the position in the sense of a slot like this, the slot between D1 and D2 cannot be a construction because it has no stable meaning. But there are some weak correlations between post-clausal position and concessive contrastives and medial position and emphasis. But those are only tendencies. They do not occur with all relevant discourse structuring marker types. So today I talked about networks as a metaphor for connectivities and relationships between constructions that are believed to be activated in the brain. Taxonomic inheritance networks model relationships between microconstructions and more abstract subschemas. and changes in network relationships between members of the schema have been studied in Hilbert. This is the notion of constructional space. Changes in the network relationships between schemas and sub-schemas remain to be studied. That was the point of the end before the break. So this brings me to the end, and thank you for your attention and your participation. I hope these lectures will inspire you to make further contributions to diachronic construction grammar, and especially ones addressing pragmatics. And I think it's really important that there is work done on Chinese and not just on English. I think it will be very clear that one needs to do very, very detailed corpus work to find out what the pragmatic changes are. And so it's very useful to do it on a language that is one's native language. I think there has been quite a bit of work in Japanese and in English, but not perhaps so much in Chinese and in many other languages. So with this, and I hope for your future contributions. Now I'd like to turn to questions and comments, challenges, and anything they came up in the last 2 weeks, which we had questions about.